There's a book by C.S. Lewis that I've been reading a lot in the last few months because we've been using it at these places where I'm a chaplain. One's called Exeter House, which is across the street from Town Hall on 8th and Seneca, and the other one is called Park Shore, which is at the end of Madison on Lake Washington. Anyway, this book is called A Grief Observed, and it's C.S. Lewis wrote this after his wife died. It was like a journal, although I'm sure that he went through it because it's too well written to just be a journal. But it is a journal, you can tell. You can tell this guy is dealing with really severe grief. And because he's a writer, you know, and he'd written many, many, many things, you know, many, many, many articles, many, many books, both in Christian theology and in literature. You know, about literature, because that's what he taught at Oxford and later Cambridge. And the severity of his grief, I think, is related to the fact that he didn't get married until he was almost 58. And, you know, these people that were sort of professors and academic types who lived in Oxford and Cambridge in those days, in the 50s and earlier, it was really kind of a bachelor kind of a thing. And I don't think he ever thought he would be married. And this person came into his life, whose name was Joy Davidman, and she was really kind of an amazing person. Most of his friends didn't like her. You know, she was from New York. She was an ex-communist. She was Jewish. She was not afraid to push what she believed was right, to say what she thought. And Lewis was only married to her for a short time because she got cancer, and the cancer, even though she went into remission in kind of an amazing way, which Lewis really fervently believed really was God healing her. You know, I mean, a priest, basically he got married to her in a hospital room when the doctor had already told her that there was nothing that could be done for her. And the priest who married them, priest of the Church of England, also prayed for her to get well, which he did a lot in different parts of his work. And she recovered. And they had this kind of remarkable thing that went on for several years. Then, in a routine examination, it was clear that the cancer had come back really seriously, and she had a very, very painful last few months. And in this book, which is the great thing about reading it, is it's so honest. I mean, it's about him, his own feelings. And the great thing about his other books has to do with, you know, he wrote these wonderful children's books, and he wrote these really interesting novels, and he wrote these wonderful kind of pretty much philosophical arguments for Christianity. But this is somebody basically not hiding anything, it seems like. In fact, that's why he never signed his name to it. This book was never published with his name as long as he was alive. After he died, the person who was the executor of sort of his literary estate said, let's put his name on it. You know, he didn't tell us we couldn't, you know, so they put his name on it. And I don't think the only reason Lewis wanted his name off of it when he was alive was because he's so angry at this happening that he really says some pretty heavy stuff for someone who had spent a lot of time trying to give us reasons for believing in God. I mean, he says some really heavy things about God in the worst stages of this grief. And also, I think he didn't really want his name on it because he really is vulnerable in this. I mean, it's sort of it's really an amazing thing to read it. One of the things that struck me as I've been reading this thing, I've read it like 5 or 6 times now, because every time you use it for a group of people, you have to reread it. And you know, one thing he did that I could not figure out is he was very worried about the fact that he thought that he was going to totally distort her memory in his own mind. He thought, I'm just going to turn her into something that I kind of want her to be instead of who she really is. And I'll do that just by selecting out certain memories, leaving out all the rest, And that, and I will end up doing that, and it won't be the real Joy Davidman that I'm thinking about. And I could not figure out why that was such a big thing to him until I realized how much he loved her. He loved her so much that he did not want to have something else instead of her in his mind. Even however attractive it might be to create some other thing that he liked. And anyway, I want to just read one paragraph from this because it illustrates what I'm talking about. He just says, "Today I had to meet a man I haven't seen for 10 years. And all that time I had thought I was remembering him well. How he looked and spoke and the sort of things he said. The first 5 minutes of the real man shattered the image completely. Not that he had changed. On the contrary, I kept on thinking, yes, of course, I'd forgotten that he thought this, or disliked that, or knew so-and-so, or jerked his head back that way. I had known all these things once, and I had recognized them the moment I met them again, but they had all faded out of my mental picture of him. And when they were all replaced by his actual presence, the total effect was quite astonishingly different from the image I had carried about with me for these 10 years. How can I hope that this will not happen to my memory of H? I mean, her name's Joy, but he calls her middle name was Helen, and I suppose that's why he comes up with this initial H, but he doesn't want anyone to know who it is, you know, or who he is when he writes the book. How can I hope that this will not happen to my memory of H? That it is not happening already. Slowly, quietly, like snowflakes, like the small snowflakes that come down when it is going to snow all night. Little flakes of me, my impressions, my selections, are settling down on the image of her. The real shape will be quite hidden in the end. 10 minutes, 10 seconds of the real H would correct all this. And yet, even if those 10 seconds were allowed me, 1 second later, the little flakes would begin to fall again. The rough, sharp, cleansing tang of her otherness is gone." So in other words, he, for the time being, he's not going to be around her. So she can't do anything about the possible distortion in his mind of who she is, which could just proceed further and further and further, just like it did with this person that he hadn't seen for 10 years. And because he loved her so much, that really bothered him. And one of the interesting things about reading this book, by the way, is that he does get better, you know, in the course of it, in the course of writing this journal. I mean, in my opinion, writing a journal if you're going through grief is a great thing to do, and it definitely worked for him. He gets better and better. So he's not saying these things toward the end, these kind of desperate things, and his relationship with God comes back and all that kind of stuff. But what he's dealing with there, I think, is a very real thing. Because our memories, which are wonderful gifts, also enable us to kind of move things around and alter them. And I think that if you're like I am, that we do that with Jesus. Now, let me give an example. My picture of Jesus is made up of many, many, many memories of being in Sunday school, being in church, talking to people, watching movies, reading the Bible. And there are little images in my mind of Jesus doing things. And I don't know how many of them are faithfully reproducing things in the Bible, and how many of them are just stuff that I've kind of altered in various ways. But I know I leave out a lot of things. In other words, the stuff that's in there, the stuff that sticks like flypaper, are just certain kinds of images of him. You know, like the one where the disciples are trying to shoo away these little kids, and Jesus says, "Don't do that. Let these children come to me." And he takes one, holds it in his arms. Well, that's in there. I mean, I think the first time I ever heard that, I was in Sunday school, and boy, that was there from then on. And other ones, you know, were like the ones that we'll be thinking about as we get near Good Friday, where Jesus increasingly realizes he's going to be killed if he goes to Jerusalem, but he's going to do it anyway, because that's how he completes his mission. In other words, he's got to go there and speak. That's the city. That's the city in the Holy Land. And he's going to go there. He's going to give his message. If he gets killed, he gets killed. I mean, I remember all those things. This kind of a person who loves us so much that that's just going to be the way it is. It's all right. Or in Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane praying, you know, Lord, if I don't have to go through this, please spare me this. Nevertheless, if it is your will, then your will be done. But there's other things that don't stick. And I mean, how do I know that the ones that don't stick, I mean, the ones that I read and I just immediately forget, aren't the important ones, or aren't at least very important? Now, to me, this one that we have today is an example of the kind that may very well not stick. Like this week, at these places where I work as a chaplain, we read this passage. And nobody said anything afterwards. I mean, usually the people that I'm working with have opinions about these passages. Sometimes it kind of amazes me, the stuff they say, because I'm used to teaching in churches, and these guys, a lot of them, don't hesitate. I mean, partly I think the older you get, the more you can say whatever you want to say. You know, they'll disagree with all kinds of stuff that I say. This, nobody says one single thing when we got done reading it. And so I had to kind of talk about it. And I think the reason that nobody said anything is that it's so different. You know, we have Jesus here, the Pharisees, who I think are probably trying to help him. It's not clear. They could be trying to trap him too. But they say, look, Herod wants to kill you. And of course, they're talking about Herod Antipas, who's the same ruler that killed John the Baptist, who controlled Galilee. And he controlled another place called Perea. And the Pharisees say, look, you've got to leave here because Herod is going to kill you if he can get his hands on you. Jesus' response is not, there's no respect for the office of ruler in his response. There's no sense like, oh, well, Herod, you know, there's no sense of awe at the importance of this person with great political and military power. He calls him a fox. Tell that fox, he says. I mean, that's different for me. I don't think of Jesus doing that. You know, talking about the guy that's the ruler of the area. Of course, he's a corrupt person who's done a lot of damage to people. But I still automatically kind of think Jesus is going to have some sort of respect for the office of ruler that he's got. And he also says, tell that fox that I'm going to be healing people. I'm going to be praying for people to get well and doing various things, and I'll probably be gone in 3 days. And he sort of seems to be saying, tell him he doesn't need to worry too much about me because I'm going to be in Jerusalem, because it's impossible for a prophet to die outside of Jerusalem. Now, what is that? It's impossible for a prophet to die outside of Jerusalem. He's referring to himself as a prophet. Now, how often do we think of Jesus as a prophet? But he's calling himself a prophet because when he says, I'm going to go to Jerusalem because it's impossible for a prophet to die outside of Jerusalem, that only makes sense if he's talking about himself being a prophet. But we forget that he's a prophet. I mean, he's a prophet and he's also the Son of God. He's here to give up his life for us, but he's also here to tell the truth. And he's also concerned, the way these prophets all were concerned, about the whole society and kind of collective problems and the effect of corrupt, greedy leaders on all the people and the effect of distorted rules and regulations on the poor and on people. He's concerned about all that stuff. He's not just concerned about individual people. He's concerned about this bigger picture. And we see that also when he talks about Jerusalem. And this is not the only time he does this, by the way. If you read Luke, where Jesus is coming into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, he weeps over Jerusalem for this very reason. It's really kind of an amazing thing that he talks about there as he's coming into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, of the sadness that he feels for Jerusalem losing this opportunity, being indifferent to what he's saying to them. And you almost get the feeling he knows what's going to happen, that there's going to be this war with the Roman army, and a huge number of people are going to get killed. It'll be a horrible experience. And that's what prophets do, that kind of thing. The thing about the prophets were that God spoke to them, and they spoke to the people, and they were not just speaking about individual people, they were speaking about the whole society often, the things that need to be corrected, the things that are wrong and that are destroying people. And that's what he's doing here. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets. What a sad thing it is. The city where the temple is corrupt. And the things going on are leading it further and further away from God. Now, what's interesting about this to me is that, I'm saying this to myself, actually, but instead of kind of regretting when I run into one of these passages and think, wait a second, I don't relate to this, what I want to do, and I especially want to do it during the season of Lent, is kind of open my mind wider and take it in, you know, hear it, because this is about Jesus. This is a profound thing about him. I mean, he was a prophet as well as this kind of leader who was coming to lead us back to God. If we can get this deeper image where we hold the different parts of the reality together instead of leaving it out, it brings us closer to him. And so what I think would be a great thing in the season of Lent would be for us to say, I'm really going to hear this stuff. I'm going to try to get away from, like in my own case, sort of my top 40 passages, you know, fabulous 40 passages from the Gospels, and try to include the other ones, the ones that don't stick because they seem a little strange, and pray, Lord, please help me to get closer to the real Jesus. This is what C.S. Lewis would have loved to have had, would be something that he could read that would have really shown him Joy Davidman without the distortion. But we have that when it comes to Jesus. We have the Gospels. And if we read them saying, you know, Lord, show me what's here that I may not know about or that I don't actually naturally gravitate to. Show me what is here. Help me to get it and think about it and meditate on it and get closer to the real Jesus. Because that gets us ready for Easter. You know? If we do that, we're going to really celebrate the resurrection on Easter Sunday. Because we're going to be celebrating the resurrection of someone that we have a deeper sense about, a deeper connection to. Amen.